of reporting things. My host, Owen Maroney, whom I have yet to meet. Ah, there you are. My host, Owen Maroney, and my very good friend, Colleen Harvey Brown, sent me an email asking me if I could come up here for a couple of weeks, a few weeks ago. Wonderful. Going to talk about this CGS no interaction theorem. CGS stands for Khoury, Jordan, Sudarshan. My special qualification for presenting this talk is that I am sufficiently ancient to have actually been active at the time this theorem was published in 1963. But I was also involved in some related research. I'll split the talk up into four parts. First, discussing the prevailing atmosphere prior to and up to the time of the publication of the theorem. Then some discussion of the actual approach of CJS and their attitudes, a discussion of some of the aftermath, and then in the last section, which, as you can tell, these green numbers are sort of the number of transparencies that I have to use in these sections. So section four will be the longest, discussing position operators for any system in Lorentz covariant quantum theory. I have my doubts that I'll really finish what I intend to talk about. I'd like to, because it's this last stuff that's my own work, and the very last stuff is the creme de la creme of my own work, but I have my doubts that I'll actually get to it. But we'll see how far it goes. I won't be able to do justice to any of the people and their work that I talk about. There isn't time, but I'll be conveying to you my general overall impression of what they had to say in various papers. Insofar as this talk has a certain archaeological dig character about it, I brought a few ancient artifacts along. Nothing digital download, no Xerox. These are actual reprints from the original publisher, the journal. Here's a preprint. These things were our only means of communication in those ancient days. The prevailing... Oh, it's not here. Prevailing atmosphere prior to 1963. QED and renormalization. QED was an incredibly successful quantum field theory empirically, but it worked only with renormalization, which an awful lot of people at that time still saw as the canceling of infinities against infinities. However systematically one did it, it made a lot of people feel uncomfortable. And prior to the 60s, there was very little prospect for a successful application of that kind of quantum field theory to the weak interactions or the strong interactions. The weak interactions looked as though they were going to be completely non-renormalizable. They were weak, so you ought to be able to use perturbation theory, but it didn't look like it was going to be a renormalizable theory because you have a four-particle point interaction. People were starting to look for mediating the interaction by the exchange of massive vector bosons, but that kind of thinking did not catch on for quite some time or turn into a successful theory. Strong interactions, people were widely convinced, wouldn't have a successful application of quantum field theory at all, since because it was strong interactions and the hope of being able to make any progress with perturbation theory seemed very wild indeed. And so S-matrix theory was on the rise, but S-matrix theory had many aspects about it that convinced a lot of people, or at least made them doubt, the adequacy of the theory to handle all of the interesting physical questions that one could ask. And so there was an impulse to develop alternative models of interactions, in particular to explore the possibility of direct particle interactions. And people started writing as far back as 1947. Christian Möller, in a long contribution to the Communications Development Institute study, had a study of various position operators that could be of interest in describing particles and multi-particle systems and the interactions of particles in relativistic quantum theory. Price followed that in 1948. did a similar study, but going a bit beyond Mueller in some respects. I'm not going to say much about Price and Mueller in the early portion of the talk, because I'll be making comments that are related to their work later on. Then we come to this keepsake issue of Reviews of Modern Physics, Volume 21, which had, in back-to-back papers, Dirac's famous paper on forms of dynamics, followed by the Newton-Digger position operator paper, followed by the paper on Wheeler-Feynman electrodynamics. The only paper of these that I will be commenting on is Newton-Digger, but I listed the others here because they are in this same, their contributions in this same atmosphere of looking for alternative models of relativistic particle interaction. Wheeler-Feynman was classical. Wigner is quantum mechanical, Dirac's forms of dynamics is quantum mechanical, but there was always the prospect of moving in the quantum mechanical direction with Wheeler-Feynman electrodynamics. Then in 1953 and 1961, there are two papers by Bakhanji and Thomas, actually two papers by, one by Thomas, one by Bakhanji and Thomas, on direct particle interactions, Hamiltonian canonical formalism in relativistic quantum mechanics. And Folby had a model very similar to the Bakhanji and Thomas model, but the implementation of Folby's model went further by virtue of using a perturbative expansion in actually inverse powers of the square of the speed of light. But these papers had certain objectionable features. People started to focus on it. I'm going to have some quotes, sometimes extensive quotes from some of these papers. The Newton-Wigner position operator paper, if I go like this, see that recently focused? Yeah, okay. In the Newton-Wigner position operator paper, there's a statement, it may be well to remember at this point, that the position operators to which our postulates lead necessarily commute with each other, that is, have commuting complements. That's because one of their postulates was that you had states that would go orthogonal to themselves under arbitrarily small spatial translations in any direction. That guaranteed that the states were simultaneous eigenstates, x, y, and z complement of position, and that guaranteed that the position operator that resulted with the commuting complements. And that a state which is localized at the origin in one coordinate system at t equals zero is not localized in a moving coordinate system, even if the origins coincide at t equals zero. That wasn't something they were after. That was something that fell out after they imposed the intuitively appealing axioms that they felt were justified, all of which involved just the Euclidean group. Hence, our operators Q super K have no simple covariant meaning under relativistic transformations. I underlined that statement in red because after having read this paper with admiration for the work that they did in it, I came to that line. And I said to myself, it was sort of a galvanizing statement for a lot of my subsequent research, no, this cannot be right. There must be simple covariant meaning under relativistic transformations for these position operators. If I get far enough in my talk, I'll tell you what I believe that simple covariant meaning happens to be. Then we come to the Bakhanji and Thomas model, 1953, and in it we have this statement, it is not implied, nor is it true, that even in non-quantum mechanics there exist world lines, R sub I equals Q sub I of T, for the particles, that are the same loci in space-time when transformed by the corresponding Lorentz transformations, unless there is no interaction and particles are without spin. You see, this is essentially the same feature that Newton and Wigner were talking about. Namely, it appears at first glance that the position operators that these people are dealing with do not obey what came to be called an invariant worldline condition. That is to say, for instance, if you took an expectation value of these position operators, and I'm always, by the way, I'm always going to be talking as though I'm in the Heisenberg picture, so it's the operators that are carrying the time dependence. So let's suppose we take an expectation value in a Heisenberg picture state of one of these position operators, and we watch that expectation value evolve with time. And then we perform a Lorentz transformation and look at the same thing, the expectation value, its evolution in time, and the transform frame of reference. The two world lines will not be the same. There is no invariance of the world line under a Lorentz transformation if you're thinking of the expectation value. And if you can write down operator conditions that the operator should satisfy for satisfying a kind of operator value invariant world line condition, a trickier concept, those are violated as well. And since the people who were doing this, both Newton and Wigner, when they were looking for the position operator, Kamji and Thomas, when they were building their models for direct particle interactions, they all had in mind the notion of these particles as being point entities. Therefore, it was exceedingly counterintuitive that the position operators they were working with would violate the invariant world line condition. Notice this phrase, R without spin. That's my emphasis, putting it in the red parentheses. And that's a consequence of the fact that if they are not without spin, it turns out that they violate the invariant world line condition even in the absence of interactions. If there's no spin carried by the various particles, then it is only in the presence of interactions that the invariant world line condition is violated. We've carried through a transformation from particle to center of mass, I emphasize, and no other motion variables. The center of mass statement is somewhat of a misnomer. It would be much better to refer to it as global coordinates rather than center of mass, because it doesn't, the position operator in question does not satisfy the simplest feature that you would expect the center of mass position operator to satisfy. We'll talk about that later, what that might be. We've carried through a transformation from particle to center of mass and relative motion variables in relativity mechanics at the cost of giving up the assumption of invariant world lines. Then we come to Foldy's model. Focus on the quote. And as I said, he built a model very, very similar to the Bekhemji and Thomas model, but explored further the idea of actually solving the dynamical problem by doing perturbative expansions in inverse powers of the square of the speed of light. We feel that the direct application of Lorentz transformation equations for space and time coordinates to the coordinates of a particle at a particular time instant, while relevant in classical mechanics, cannot be naively carried over into quantum mechanics, where then he gives a list of what one might call the mysteries of quantum mechanics from a classical perspective that we might use to justify abandoning the intuitive requirement of invariant world lines, even for entities that are supposedly like particles. And he refers to things like incompatible observables, Heisenberg uncertainty relations, the spread of wave functions, etc. Now I have some equations here indicating what the Bekhemjian, Thomas, and Foldy Poincaré generators look like for the composite system consisting of two supposedly point particles. The momentum operator is just the sum of the momentum operators for the particles. The angular momentum operator is just the sum of orbital angular momentum operators for the particles. But that angular momentum operator can be rewritten in terms of a global position operator for the system as a whole. That's the thing that Bekhemji and Thomas referred to as a center of mass position operator. It isn't really a center of mass position operator. And the total momentum plus the internal angular momentum. All of these position operators are Newton-Wigner position operators for the system in question. Q1 for the first particle, Q2 Q2 for the second particle, capital Q for the composite system consisting of both particles. And when we say that capital Q is a position operator for the composite system, what is technically meant by that is that you can give an explicit expression for that position operator in terms of the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group for that composite system. You can do the same for little q1 and little q2 for the parts of the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group that correspond to those constituents of the global system. However, it turns out that this capital Q doesn't satisfy the invariant mode line condition, whether there's any interactions between the particles or not. Neither Batenjian and Thomas nor Folby make any comment to that effect. And in the seminars, by the way, that Eugene Stefanovich was giving, in his seminar on Lorentz invariant quantum theory, he makes a comment, I think it's in his 40th image on the screen, the effect that this global Q does satisfy the invariant Hilbert line condition, whether interactions are present or not. It's exactly the opposite. It fails to satisfy the invariant Hilbert line condition, whether the interactions are present or not. And it's all because of the presence of this this non-zero internal angular momentum. Even though the individual particles are supposed not to be carrying any spin, if they're just moving as free particles like that, there's non-zero internal angular momentum in the composite system, and that's enough to guarantee the Wigner operator for the composite system to violate the invariant Lorentz. The time translation generator has this form, of course, where V is the interaction, but what Batenjian and Thomas and Folby do is they explicitly put all the interaction in the mass operator. So the change in the mass operator from its non-interacting form is expressed in terms of relative variables, internal relative variables, so as to preserve the Lie algebra relations that have to be satisfied by the global generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group. And then a peculiar feature of the relativistic case is that the generator of boosts, which in the absence of interactions, forget the U is the interaction term, in the absence of interactions, it's just the time translation generator for particle 1, symmetrized product of its position, plus the time translation generator for particle 2, symmetrized product of its position, minus the total momentum, Ct, remember, in the Heisenberg picture, plus any interaction term. If one was doing non-relativistic theory, Galilean invariance, there would be no interaction part of the boost generator. But in the Lorentz case, one must have an interaction part of the boost generator whenever an interaction is added to the time translator. And then one can rewrite that in this form using only the global operators, where this is the global Wigner operator, and this is the and so forth. The interaction that makes up U is partly present in this H, partly in this H, and partly in that H. Okay, so those are the comments about the prevailing atmosphere in some of the papers that preceded the CJS hearing. Now we come to the approach to CJS. Use of modern physics 35. And I want to first read this quote. We distinguish two different kinds of assumptions that occur under the heading of relativistic invariance. The first of these reflects the principle that the laws of physics should be invariant under changes of reference frame. The second is an assumption that certain quantities transform under changes of reference frame in a particular manner, and they call that kind of requirement manifest invariance. Now, I have to say that it seems to me that they're stretching a point to emphasize this distinction. Because if on one hand you want to emphasize that the laws of physics should be invariant under changes of reference frame, that's a rather vacuous assertion, unless you make some statement about how certain quantities transform under the change from one inertial reference frame to another. to simply say that the laws of physics are invariant, like you go from one frame of reference to another, but to make no statement as yet as to how individual quantities that will enter into those laws of physics are going to change under the transformation, is to say virtually nothing. But they make an emphasis of this distinction, and they turn the distinction in, they give the distinctions the technical content in the paper by focusing on the Lie algebra for the generators of the symmetry group for their stipulation from laws of physics would be invariant under changes in the reference frame, and by focusing on commutators of the generators with specific position operators as the way of making declarations about how certain quantities transform under changes to reference frame. The requirement of symmetry under the relativistic transformation group can be satisfied in a simple manner. A requirement of manifest invariance also may be satisfied quite simply. But the combined requirements may restrict the theory so that it is capable only of describing non-interacting particles. We show this is the case of Lorentz symmetric theory for a pair of particles. Now, actually, they don't show all of that. What they show is that in the standard canonical approach, the Lie algebra for the Poincaré generators are very easily satisfied, but the commutators of the Poincaré generators and the position operators cannot be what you intuitively want them to be, and in that way they violate the invariant world condition. They developed a universal canonical formalism in this rather long-winded paper. It's very verbose. This universal formalism is set up so that without changing the formalism, you can handle the classical case and the quantum case, you can handle the Galilean case and the Lorentzian case. The only changes that occur is that the symbols in the formalism take on slightly different meanings in those various cases, but the formalism stays the same. And we'll talk about what they really mean by relativistic symmetry and the transformation of particle positions. Said some of this, the universal canonical formalism treats all of those together. It involves a real linear space R of quantities, including a subspace of states. In the classical case, these are all functions over phase space, either for quantities regarded as functions of the canonical variables, or in the case of states, these are distributions over phase space, the kind of thing you can see in statistical mechanics. In the quantum case, they're all self-adjoint operators, either a self-adjoint operator for the state, namely what we would call a mixed state of quantum mechanics represented by a density operator, and the other self-adjoint operators represent quantities of interest. They introduce a Lie bracket on the product of R with R. In the classical case, the Lie bracket is Poisson brackets, and quantum is commutators over IH bar, the same thing. And then they give examples of what all the one-parameter automorphism groups look like in their formulas, and I've just reproduced these formulas to show you exactly what their equations look like for this formalism. That's not just a quantum mechanical equation, that's a classical equation as well. Relativistic symmetry. Here's the Lie algebra for the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group. Everything's the same in the Galilean and the Lorentzian in the classical and quantum mechanical case, except for these last two involving the boost generators. In the Lorentzian case, the commutator of two boost generators is the negative anti-symmetric symbol summed with the angular momentum generator, the rotation generator, or in the Galilean case, it's zero on the right-hand side. And the commutator, the Lie bracket between the boost and the spatial translator is a Kronecker delta times the time translator in the Lorentzian case, or just the mass parameter, total mass parameter in the Galilean case. There are some questions about dimensions. Dimensions of K change a little bit as you go from one case to another, but if you don't worry about H bars and C's, we can ignore that. In general, for a composite system, say a system that's thought of as made up of two parts, if there are no interactions, all of the generators will split this way, generators referring to each of the constituents. As soon as one turns on interactions, the generators referring to the constituents acquire time dependence. The global generator remains time independent, and in general, there will be an interaction term added, but in some instances it will be zero, that is, for some generators it will be zero, for others non-zero. We have a Lie algebra that looks like this for the constituent generators, and looks like this with the same Fs in both cases for the global generators. Now, in the particular case of both Galilean and Lorentzian symmetry, the time translation generator is modified by the presence of interactions. That's just what we recognize changing the Hamiltonian by turning on potential energy to have you get the interactions. In the Lorentzian case only, as I said before, the boost generator must be modified by adding an interaction term. And the interaction term is related. These are not added independently. They are added in a highly correlated way. So all of that's the easy part. That's satisfying the demand of the laws of physics or invariant of the chain of reference. Then we come to considerations of the type that concern how certain quantities transform in going from one inertial frame to another. And here we have a picture of a world line of a hypothetical point particle. And two frames, a T and X frame, and a T prime and an X prime frame. And at a certain time, T0, in the unprimed frame, we identify the position of the world line as X of T0. And here we identify the position of the world line as X prime of T0. In other words, these two points on the world line are being evaluated at the same numerical value of the time in the two frames of reference. The reason for that is that if you look at a classical expression of Lorentz transformation equations for position, in the case of an infinitesimal transformation, they're going to look like this, x prime and t prime, and I'm suppressing, you know, the one spatial dimension, that's why I'm not worrying about components. X prime of t prime is x of t minus delta beta, infinitesimal beta transformation, ct. Ct prime is ct minus delta beta x of t. The change in t, t prime minus c, is minus delta beta x of t over c. Question, suppose we move to the quantum mechanical case. I'm going to emphasize that, even though CJS, Louis Jordan, and Siddhartha are deeply concerned with the classical case and the quantum mechanical case. But suppose we move to the quantum mechanical case. What is t prime? What is its character? I mean, here's the equation defining it. Is it a C number? We're in quantum mechanics. X is an operator. Do we take the expectation value of X here? Have something like an analog to semi-classical gravity? Or do we leave X an operator whereupon T prime becomes a Q number? How does a Q number, T prime, fit into the formulas? It doesn't. And that's one of the reasons why, in trying to get a Lie bracket relationship out of this kind of consideration, you've got to compare the positions in the two frames of reference at the same time. That is the same value of the time coordinate, so that you don't have to address this question of what is t prime if its value is different from t. And the way you do that is you write x prime of t prime as x prime of t plus delta t. Not addressing the question yet. Then you write that as x prime of t plus v of t delta t. Now, we're not ready to stop yet. It's still ambiguous. And then we write delta x of t, x prime of t minus x of t. That's the definition of delta with x of t. And it's delta beta. And you make this substitution here for delta t, treating it as an operator in the quantum mechanical domain, just inserted in this expression, delta beta times x of t v of t over c minus ct. And then, if you look at a boost, you find that in order for this expression to hold for delta x of t, you find that the lead bracket between the particle position at time t and the generated boost has this form of the Lorentz case, where this pump, this B bracket, comes from the velocity here. Now, there are some steps in that derivation that I left out, but this is sketching roughly how they get to this, which is the requirement of invariant borderline invariance, as expressed in the Kreiger and Anderson Darshan paper. This is their expression of the requirement of invariant borderline invariance, and it's the requirement that is violated in the presence of interactions. And then CJS disparage somewhat, but they take to be the attitude of Fourier. We find that we have a natural method for establishing the equations for the lead brackets of the particle positions, with the total momentum, total angular momentum, and generators of Galilean transformations, but that this method breaks down for generators of Lorentz transformations. That seems to me to be a gross misstatement. They didn't have a method that worked in every case except the boost transformations, but broke down there. It was a method that worked in all cases, but didn't give them what they wanted in the case of the boost transformations. It gave them an unequivocal result, and it's not the result they wanted. This failure could be viewed as a reason to proceed with the construction of quantum mechanical theories not including the boost B bracket equations. By that they mean invariant borderline equation, in the case of Lorentz symmetry. And then they say, it seems to us that this attitude is evident in the work of L.L. Foldy. However, we would tend to view such an attitude as having only the temporary validity of expediency. And then, to emphasize, in their derivation, which is very lengthy, they make smoothness assertions about all the functions over phase space or certain quantum generalizations of smoothness assumptions for the operators they're working with in the quantum mechanical case, in order not to have to worry about singularities in singular structure in some of their steps. And that means that our proof makes use of the requirement that all of the generators be sufficiently regular functions of the canonical variables. This rules out any generators that may contain singular terms, such as delta functions, that could represent contact interactions. In other words, they're not allowing for the possibility of direct particle interactions resulting from the particles actually bumping into one another and recoiling. That's not allowed. The only interactions that their system will permit is direct particle interaction between, in effect, instantaneous forces of resistance. And so there's a certain sense in which it's not surprising that they get this no-interaction theorem in a relativistic context. The only thing that's surprising is that the theorem takes the form of saying that the world lines will violate invariant world line condition. The presence of interactions. How are we doing? Okay, I have a transparency that if there's any discussion of this, people want to talk about some of the details of the CJS derivation, we can do that. But it's lengthy, it grinds out. What they do is they make canonical transformation after canonical transformation after canonical transformation, gradually beating the generators, showing that you could gradually beat the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group into a form in which they have just the form of like a generator. The global generator is the global generator referring to particle 1 plus the global generator referring to particle 2 and nothing else if you insist on satisfying the invariant borderline condition, so you can know the matches. It's a long process. The aftermath. Fritz Koester had a model of direct particle interaction in which he didn't worry about the invariant world line condition because he turned it into a kind of scattering theory model, not anything like analytic S matrix theory, but a model in which he was only concerned with how the, quote, observables of the particles behaved asymptotically in the distant past when they were coming in towards the collision, in the distant future when they were separating from the collision. What they did in the midst of the collision interaction, he said, what do we know about that? Actually, I'm sure I'm able to use comments. And I'll say something about Eckstein's theorem, the Wigner-Van Dam model, and the Colnay industry and the Fleming industry. Many papers. I'm not going to talk about the Colnay industry at all because it's, I think it's somewhat different in focus and emphasis from what I am talking about, but it was provoked by these concerns and these issues, and he wrote many papers during that period. I also wrote many papers on the subject, but in my case, I was not at all motivated by a desire to retain or recapture the invariant world line condition because I felt the invariant world line condition was unwarranted to impose in the first place because of my conviction based upon early work on the Wigner position operator and other considerations that there are no point particles in relativistic quantum mechanics in any case. So for me, the CJS theorem was important only in the classical domain, where you could obviously say, well, I want to investigate what happens to point particles in relativistic interactions and can that be formulated in the Hamiltonian canonical formalism. But there are reasons that we may get to for believing that there are no point particles in relativistic quantum mechanics. And as I was reminded yesterday at dinner by Jos, a high-energy physicist will tell us that the leptons are all point particles. But what the high-energy physicists mean when they say the leptons are point particles is that in scattering phenomena, they see no evidence of internal structure. And I want to draw a distinction between the absence of internal structure and the presence of space-like extension. I grant that there are many conceptual issues about the relationship between those two assertions that remain to be resolved. But I don't think the high energy physics declaration of point status of the leptons because of the absence of internal structure is really warranted. And there are arguments based on these position operator considerations for arguing for space-like extension of the particles. There's a criticism by Perez, 1971. And then there's Wurlich's generalization, which is a long paper in which he generalizes the whole canonical formalism so as to make it applicable to point particles that hopefully can satisfy the invariant world line condition. But note the date, 1979. That's the date when the Nobel Prize was awarded to Glashow, Weinberg, and Salam for electroweak unification. Field theory was back in business with a vengeance. I mean, there was no longer much of the original motivation for this kind of investigation of direct particle interaction. It's just that having been tried and the CJS theorem having appeared, it whetted a number of people's interest to keep working on it. Custer's point. Relativistic particle quantum mechanics is a possible alternative to quantum field theory on one hand and analytic S matrix theory on the other. One may inquire whether conditions habitually imposed are really necessary or are the results of confounded prejudice. The assumption that the individual particle coordinates are observable at all times leads to the requirement that they form invariant world lines. And in a quantum theory of strongly interacting particles, it is reasonable to follow Heisenberg and assert that the only observables are S matrix elements and the masses and dynamical variables of free particles. And Koester imposes a separability or cluster decomposition principle on his model. but runs into trouble as soon as he introduces more than three particles. He can satisfy all of his requirements in the cluster decomposition for up to three particles or more. X times theory. What Eckstein does, well, let's read some quotes and then I'll comment on what he does. Relativistic quantum mechanical particle theories, as contrasted with field theories, have recently attracted great attention. Closer inspection shows that the success of quantum mechanical particle theories is bought for a price. Particle variables Q sub I are bigger position operators which do not transform covariantly. Instead of investigating specific alternatives for position operators, we examine particle theories in which the single particle observables are not necessarily given a physical interpretation. We give a definition of a particle concept which is more general. Our definition of particle requires only that it preserves its individuality under Lorentz transformations. What he means by it is that boosts are entirely kinematic, as they are in the Galilean case. Because he's going to demand that under a Lorentz boost, just as in Euclidean transformations, single particle observables do not mix with other particles. That is, the boosts are purely kinematic. And again, even though he doesn't impose invariant Bode-Lyn condition on the position, he finds out he can't have any interaction with this condition. It's a much broader condition. And it's just as effective in ruling out. The Wigner-Van Dam model. Now, the Wigner-Van Dam model is somewhat out of the complex of kinds of efforts that I've been talking about. But as they say, there appears to be a body of opinion according to which an interaction between point particles must be via a field if the theory is to be Lorentz invariant. That's part of the reaction that had been provoked by all these studies and things like the CJS theorem. Well, evidently we must give up because the only way particles can interact with the theory classical quantum is if there's something like a field mediating the interaction, which was, of course, the prevailing wisdom. But nevertheless, it had been given an emphasis by the kind of work and the problems that were encountered that I've been talking about. But Wigner and Van Dam go on to say, the present consideration show that these opinions must be revised. The equations which we shall consider postulate that a particle interacts at a definite space-time point with those points at the other orbits which are space-like with respect to the point under consideration. In other words, if we're looking at two world lines, two interacting particles, particle 1, that's this one over here, is influenced at the point C by all of particle 2's world line between A and B, or separate future light from the past light from C. And similarly, particle 2's world line is influenced at F by all that portion of particle 1's world line in E. And you can have non-trivial interaction in there in that model with the invariant Bode-Lyn condition satisfied, but it's completely outside the conformalism with CJS, Thomas, Foldy, and Kester, Eckstein, and others wanted to quote. Finally, Perez's criticism. As late as 1971. Some authors propose to relax the traditional identification of the canonical coordinates Q sub I with the physical positions X sub I of the particles. What he means by that is the physical positions are clearly going to satisfy invariant Bode-Lyn. So if you're going to use some Q sub I's that don't satisfy invariant Bode-Lyn condition, that means you're breaking the connection between the Q sub I and the physical position. It thus seems that one can easily forego the requirement that the canonical Q sub I transform like geometrical coordinates. However, it is not so. The purpose of this note is to show that if no restriction is put on the transformation law of the canonical coordinates Q sub I, then the principle of relativity becomes vacuous. If fulfillment of the Poisson bracket relations does not guarantee Lorentz invariance, and thus further restrictions are imposed on the canonical variables. Now, the spirit of this is fine, but he goes, it's a bit too strong. To be sure, some transformation requirements must be imposed. That goes back to my comment about objecting to the CJS disentangling of the frame invariance of the laws of physics completely from the transform properties of certain dynamical variables. Some transformation requirements must be imposed to give physical content, but not necessarily those of geometrical coordinates, not necessarily the invariant world line. And nowhere does Perez show that that is the thing that must be imposed. And without these requirements that Perez is talking about, what is lost is not Lorentz invariance. Because all Lorentz invariance I would want to claim requires is that you have a unitary representation of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group acting on the observables, acting on the states of the system. And you've got Lorentz invariance. You may have no viable physical theory because you may not even have a consistent set of physical concepts applicable to the operators that the unitary representations of the Lorentz transformations are being applied to. So what you lose is physical viability of Lorentz invariance. So I think his assertion is a bit too strong. And then finally, a comment on Rolex generalization. It's still after point particles, it's still after satisfying the invariant word line condition, and in the quantum mechanical case, I would still want to argue that that is not a, that's not a warrant of requirement. And now finally, it's a, do you have a rough idea when we started?
We started in the middle of the late side, so we can go back to time.
Okay. I think I'll get to the end of that. Position operators for any system in Lorentz covariant quantum theory. By the way, I prefer to use the phrase Lorentz covariant quantum theory rather than relativistic quantum mechanics because my experience is that in relativistic quantum mechanics, when you use that phrase, a lot of people, it seems, carry a lot of baggage from relativistic classical physics automatically over into the discussion. But Lorentz covariant quantum theory is less effective in provoking that to happen to the person who's listening to you talk about the subject. So I prefer the phrase Lorentz covariant quantum theory. In other words, when simply I'm interested in imposing Lorentz covariance on a quantum theory and then examining to see what features of classical relativistic mechanics carry over and what features don't. We're going to talk about global position operators for any system, and by a position operator for a system, I mean a position operator that is explicitly constructible out of the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group for that system. Or if that system is part of a larger composite system, it's expressed, it's constructible out of the contribution that that system makes to the global generators. And there will be three such position operators we'll talk about. One I'll call the center of energy, which is a generalization of the center of mass. The other is the Newton, the second is the Newton-Wigner position operator, which I like to call the center of spin for reasons that will become clear. And the third is the geometrical centroid or center of geometry for reasons that will become clear, but I'm not entirely happy with the name. And then maybe we'll get to talk about it. Now, one of the main points that I'm going to be emphasizing in these discussions with three different kinds of position operators is one, the sense in which they violate the invariant world line condition, if they do, they all do but one, even in the absence of their corrections. And secondly, how it is that they give rise to the notion that the particles that are represented are extended entities. The center of energy. First of all, I have a set of six relations at the top of the transparency that are going to be satisfied by all of the position operators at the top. So center of energy, in your center of spin, and the center of the arm. All of them will satisfy these six relations, where P is momentum, H is time translation or energy, J is rotation generator or angular momentum, and here, this is if the H is the H that belongs to the same system as the X does, in which case the velocity operator is just the ratio of momentum to energy. And this is the case where the commutator is with the total time translation generator, the total composite system. It's in a composite system. And what you get here is the velocity operator, which may, in the presence of interactions, differ from this ratio, P sub A, P sub A, over H. These hold for all the positions. Definition of the center of energy. It's explicitly built this way out of the energy operator, the boost operator, and the momentum operator. Remember, we're in the Heisenberg picture, so it's an operator with time dependence. The time dependence is explicitly entered here, because all of these operators are constant. This is in the absence of interactions. It's a closed system. So it's just a translating position with steady velocity. If we turn on interactions, if we put this system inside a composite system with interactions, then the constituent subsystem H, K, and P all require time dependence, and the definition of X of T is modified only by including the time dependence of the generators that go into this construction. What is the reason for the name? Why call this the center of energy? It is because, if it's a two-part global composite system, here's the total energy for the composite system, here's the center of energy position for the composite system, here's the energy for the subsystem 1, center of energy for subsystem 1, energy for subsystem 2, center of energy for subsystem 2, and here's the interaction that belongs to the boost, because this is essentially the boost operator for the composite system. And if we look in a quantum field theoretic context at what these things look like, V will be some integral over all of space of an energy density, an interaction energy density. U, the interaction part that goes on the boost, is an integration over all of space of position variable, position operator of anything, field theoretic position variable times the energy density. H is this integral over the 0-0 complement of stress energy momentum tensor, and H symmetrized product X, that colon there indicates a symmetrized product of the operators, is this integral. I have a discussion of some aspects of these latter equations posted to the PIT PhilSci Archive of Quantum Mechanics 2002, ID number 66. Okay, some properties of this center of energy. Properties that make some people rather disinclined to try and pay much attention to it. Suppose we use it to break up the total angular, the contribution of the angular momentum of the system of interest. So here's the angular momentum of the system of interest. We insert the orbital angular momentum component that would come from using the X center of energy. And what is left over is the internal angular momentum. But this leftover internal angular momentum is not our ordinary leftover internal angular momentum. It's not what we would be inclined to call the spin of the system. First of all, it's incompatible with the orbital contribution of the angular momentum. The commutator does not vanish. Secondly, it's incompatible with the center of energy. Thirdly, the components of the center of energy are incompatible with one another, and their commutator is proportional to this internal angular momentum. So this means that this position operator, the center of energy, is going to be rather awkward in a canonical formalism. It's not going to function as one of the canonical coordinates, because a requirement for the canonical coordinate is that it has classically vanishing Poisson brackets among its Cartesian components, quantum mechanically vanishing commutators among its components. But those considerations do not deprive, I would want to argue, this position operator of physical meaning, physical significance. What is the ordinary spin, and how is it related to this odd internal angular momentum of the system? What's related in this way? Where by sigma parallel, I mean the component of sigma that's parallel to the momentum. The momentum commutes with sigma. And the parallel part of S is the same as the parallel part of sigma. The perpendicular part of S, the part of S perpendicular to the momentum, is a little bit larger than the perpendicular part of sigma. But it's this S that satisfies rotation group Lie algebra among itself. You know, S, the commutator of S sub A with S sub B is IH bar epsilon ABC, S sub C. Sigma does not satisfy that. On the other hand, if one looks at the Pauli-Lubansky 4 vector, which is very instrumental in developing the second Casimir invariant of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group, this sigma is what appears as the quantity W is proportional. W, the space components of the Pauli-Lubansky 4 vector, is the negative H times sigma. The time component, it's negative, is P dot S, which is, as we saw here, the same as P dot sigma. But sigma does appear in the Pauli-Lubansky equation. What is the commutator of this center of energy with the boost generators? Now, this is a boost generator that comes from the same system as the center of energy in the first. And that's why I have PA over H here rather than DX by DT. If the KD was the total boost, I have dx by dt here. These two terms, if you remember from our discussion of the CJS paper, these two terms are the terms that give you by themselves the invariant borderline condition if they were all at right hand side. The presence of this term is the violation of the invariant borderline condition. And it will be absent only if there is no internal angular momentum. Specific terms. Spin. The Newton-Wigner center of spin. It's defined here as Q in terms of X, the center of energy. They're separated by this term P cross X over H times H plus MC. The reason I call this the center of spin is that now if you use Q to decompose the total angular momentum into an orbital part and an internal part, the internal part is the internal angular momentum we all know and love. It's the ordinary spin, satisfying the ordinary angular momentum commutation relations among these Cartesian functions. Furthermore, that S commutes with the position operator, and the orbital and the internal angular momentum parts are mutually compatible. Furthermore, the Cartesian components of the Newton-Wigner position operator can be among themselves. So they can be used as canonical coordinates. But they are by no means the center of energy. We saw how the X was the center of energy, and now we've tacked this monster onto X in order to build Q, and there's no way Q will satisfy that center of energy condition if they rise to the name of the center of energy. So I like to call the Newton-Wigner operator the center of spin. There's an interesting relation for the square difference between the center of energy and the Newton-Wigner, and it's a quantity that is actually diagonalized in momentum velocity eigenstates for particles that are frequently referred to in scattering experiments, scattering theory analysis. So this square distance between Q and X is precisely defined. Momentum, velocity, eigenstates. And finally, well, not quite finally, but almost finally, the geometrical centroid, the third position. It's Y, I've defined it here in terms of the Newton-Wigner and in terms of the center of energy. In all these cases, all of these position operators are related by terms of the form P cross X over something involving mass and energy. Reason for the name, center of energy. This is its commutator with the boost operator. Just the invariant worldline terms, no additional terms. Now mind you, if you put this as a subsystem in a global system that has interactions, Then you may get other terms, because then you're going to have total KB. This becomes dy by dt. That doesn't violate the invariant Hilbert condition. But some additional terms pop up here as well. But so long as there's no interaction, and you're only getting contribution from the K of the system of interest, and maybe for some interactions there would also be no additional terms, but here you at least have invariant Hilbert condition satisfied for any spin, whereas the other cases already violated the invariant Hilbert condition in the presence of spin. The decomposition of the angular momentum, however, is every bit as bad as it was for the center of energy. The orbital contribution is not compatible with the internal contribution. The components of y do not commute with one another, and the commutator is very similar to what the commutators were for the center of energy. Z has the same parallel component as S, as sigma. But the z perpendicular component of the internal angular momentum is a little bigger than it was for s, which is a term a little bigger than it was for sigma. And all these square distances satisfy inequalities like that. Now, the risk of making you think that I am after a classical reconstruction of quantum mechanics, especially the relativity version, which is in fact an effort that I deplore from the very depths of my being. But I know people have gathered this for what I am now going to show you. What I am going to show you is a classical analog model, which gives you a classical intuition from which you can help yourself interpret some of these relationships. But I am not for a moment suggesting if we go looking for a classical underpinning of relativistic quantum mechanics. I think that's absurd. Suppose you consider a rotating sphere. And then you give the rotating sphere, the sphere starts out with a homogeneous mass distribution. You set it spinning. As a consequence of the spin, of course, in the relativistic classical domain, you'll start to get a concentration of the energy enhanced around the rim, and not quite so much energy concentration. Where by energy, I mean you're thinking of E is mc squared, energy mass equivalence. The center of energy is going to stay in the geometrical center. But now, hop on to a frame of reference, or give the thing a flick and send it translating, or hop on to a frame of reference translating in the opposite direction, and you now superimpose the translational motion on the rotational motion. As soon as you do that, in this case, the lower hemisphere will become more energetic than the upper hemisphere because the rotation and the translation are enhancing one another in the lower hemisphere. So the center of energy will migrate into the lower hemisphere. The center of geometry will stay right there. And the center of spin, what happens to that? It's the Newton-Vigner position. We'll come to that. If it's translating in the opposite direction, the center of energy migrates into the upper half of the sphere. And you can do classical calculations of how far the migration takes place, as indeed Muller did in his famous old textbook on special relativity. And he calculates that the radius of such a rotating translating system, if it has a given internal angular momentum and a given mass, and its radius must be greater than or equal to this S over MC, which is very closely related to the expressions I showed you before for the square differences in its position operators. In the case of the Earth, that's 10 meters. In the case of an electron, it's about the electron. Suppose we did that same model for a spherical system that is translating at 7/8 the speed of light. So that I've got the position of these positions in the classical case to scale. Right? So this distance, the radius of this ball, is the molar limit, S over NC. This is the separation between the center of geometry and the Newton-Vigner center of spin. It's classical analog. and it has a magnitude total momentum times the magnitude of the interangular minimum for mc times h plus mc, which is the total energy. And this is the separation between the center of geometry and the center of energy. It has this one. It makes this much less total. That these two, the center of spin and the center of energy, keep migrating towards the molar limit radius, and they coalesce in the limit of infinite momentum. But God forbid you should take this as an indication that I want to cross it under infinite. Finally, you might be inclined to say, okay, well, maybe I buy your argument for all spinning particles, but what about non-spinning particles? And do not still have point structure, point entity, non-spinning particles? Well, of course, we don't know of any spinless fundamental particles, possible exception to Higgs boson. All our spinless particles are now understood to be composite, certainly electrons. But nevertheless, there's another kind of argument. Suppose, and I'm not playing striptease here, I'm not going to show you the bottom of this transparency ever, because we've come to the end of the time. This is the expression for the 0-0 complement, the stress energy momentum tensor operator field for a free scalar field. But a charged scalar field, so this particle is different from the antiparticle, although that's not essential for the claim I'm going to make. And then the point I want to make is that if you take the expectation value of this in any state whatsoever consisting of one quanton, one of the quanta of that field, momentum eigenstate, position eigenstate, any superposition of them whatsoever, normalizable state, it matters not. There is no open ball throughout space at any time in which that expectation value vanishes. Now, I want to claim that that cannot be construed as just some kind of quantum mechanical fluky consequence of the uncertainty of where the quanton is. Because you can do whatever you like to try and pin the quanton down. For instance, build a state that is Newton-Wigner-wise confined to smaller and smaller balls. Always the state remains normalized because I've not gone to a position I can state. So the state remains normalized, but I can squeeze it down. And when I squeeze it down, I find that not only does this expectation value of the energy density not vanish anywhere, but it grows everywhere. So my conviction is that in this admittedly simplified model, no interacting field theory here, my contention is that the quanton is an energetically extended system. Must be in this context. You might say, well, okay, but this is baby physics, this is free field theory. What happens when you turn on interactions? I haven't a clue what happens when you turn on interactions, but I'd be willing to bet my net worth that it doesn't result in yielding states where the expectation value of the energy density is confined to a ball. That would be my interaction will not do that. They will modify the details, but they won't try all of that. Okay, sadly we can't go for the covariant formulation for all the positions.
I didn't quite understand the various strands of arguments together. Now, you could mention the Newton-Wigner approach. In that case, if I remember correctly, we impose certain conditions, for example, the components of the position of the wheel. and then you show that they don't satisfy a covariant bloodline condition, just because these eigenstates of the decision operators don't transform into eigenstates.
Yes and no. That has to be qualified. There are two, there are three things that happen with statements. With all of these position operators, with the exception of the center of geometry, set that aside because there is a circumstance in which that satisfies the operator value inherent borderline condition prevents dependence in the absence of interactions. Whereas these other position operators of energy and behavior don't even satisfy the invariant borderline condition in the absence of interactions, if it's any interactions. However, that fact is related to three features, namely that when you write down the commutator relation between the boost generator and the position operator, you get more terms on the right-hand side than you want because the invariant borderline condition satisfies. There is also the fact if you have a state that's localized at position zero, at time zero, or at any time, and you perform a Lorentz boost, you get a state that is not localized at zero or anywhere else at indefinite time. However, had I been able to go on my presentation, you would find that that state that transformed is Newton-Wigner localized at a definite point on a tilted hyperplane, a tilted space-like hyperplane, rather than a definite time. Why? How do you make sense out of that? You make sense out of that by saying the frame that you have transformed to is a frame in which the hyperplane you were looking at before, which was instantaneous, is now tilted. And the only reason you lose localizability of the Newton-Wigner eigenstates under a Lorentz boost in the ordinary way of looking at it is that you're no longer looking at the same hyperplane. You're asking for a state that was localized on this hyperplane before to be localized on that hyperplane now. And you might say, well, I mean, after all, if the localization took place at a point that's common to both of those hyperplanes, isn't it justified for me to expect that localization to survive? Answer, yes, if it's a point entity. But if it's not a point entity, that's not warranted. Because the very definition of the position operator depends, especially, it's most palpable in the case of the center of energy. But the definition of where the center of energy is as an operator value question depends upon performing this averaging process of the energy density of the system over the whole hyperplane. So if you now do that over this hyperplane, even though the hyperplanes intersect where you got localization originally, there's no reason to expect that you can get localization again because the averaging process might have displaced location. And the Newton-Wigner position operator, it has the commuting complements which allows for the possibility of precisely sharp localization. But it's still related to that center of energy, and it has all of those other quantities in it, the P and the S and the H, all of which involve, from a field theoretic perspective, these integrations over the entire hyperplane of various densities. And it seems to me that that clears up the whole interpretational issue. Now, there's still a third issue, and that is the superluminal propagation of the Newton-Wigner eigenstates. You confine them to a ball at t equals zero. At any t, however small, greater than zero, they're everywhere. They're absolutely everywhere. And, you know, it's interesting. It appears that I was one of the first people to have mentioned the superluminal evolution of the Newton-Wigner wave functions. But if you look at the paper, which is cited, which I did this, it's a little footnote. Now you might ask, why did I do that? Why did I put this statement that there's superluminal evolution for the Newton-Wigner wave function in a footnote? It's because I didn't understand what I was doing.
I had conflated in my own mind the two features, namely the violation of the preservation of localization under a Lorentz boost, which Newton and Vigor were quite aware of in their paper, with the superluminal evolution of the wave function. I thought they were two sides of the same issue at that time. And so I thought Newton and Vigor and everybody else was as aware of the superluminal evolution as they were of the violation of localization under the ordinary way of looking at Lorentz boost. And so I just thought I was making some little comment. I didn't think I was revealing anything.
So, well, that's your kind of question, or it's probably more common, but you know, I think you agree with you that you know, it would be very hard to believe that you have a quantitative context and the localized objects that you correspond to the entire product that's succeeding in the context. I guess it's very hard against this. So if you have a mind to construct position operators in the quantum field theory context, then you have to give up on the shard function position or anything like that. But one aspect that you did discuss is, you know, I would expect position operator to be perhaps useful if you talk only about one particle state. And you expect position operator not to be findable if you have two particle state or three particle state. So in that sense, the three position operators is something perhaps defined in a very restrictive context where you can restrict the set, you know, this thing over space or something which is very small.
Okay. I'm puzzled by some of the things you said. First of all, you said you wouldn't expect to be able to build position operators if you had a two particle state or three particle state. But what you can do, I'm trying to point out what you could do is you take the contributions that these subsystems make to the global generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group, and you build position operators for those constituents out of those contributions to the generators of the inhomogeneous Lorentz group, the same way, algebraically the same way as you would build them if they were by themselves, if they weren't constituents of the larger system, but if they were the whole system. And so you get these position operators for each of the particles of a three-particle or an n-particle system. And furthermore, the particle operators that you build this way are identical as regards all of their algebraic properties with the particle operators that you would extract from a field theory. That is to say, if you take a field theory, you might say, wait a minute, if I just have a field quantum field theory, how can I build any operators for a one particle system or a two particle system? Well, you suppress the Hilbert space of states to the one smart particle subspace or to the two particle subspace. Now that becomes tricky business in the presence of interactions. Because with the quantum field theory, the particle number can become indefinite, change, so on and so forth. But you can at least talk about n particle states on given hyperplanes. So when you do this sort of thing, you find that the similarity, not to say identity, between the algebraic relations that the position operator satisfied when you're approaching them via a purely particle mentality and via a field mentality is so striking that it just seems to me like there's no difference.
Distinction will also fall in the class.
in classical relativistic systems.
Yes.
Yeah. Because you could certainly build algebraically the same structures.
How exactly would that solve or alter a few fractions here? And secondly, why does it have to do with the view that elementary particles are expansion?
Well, if you have these, at least these three position operators for every elementary particle, and they have non-vanishing squared differences in all of the states, or almost all of the states for these elementary particles, I find it very hard to believe that these position operators or their expectation values are referring to something outside the particles, like the center of energy or the center of spin. And then if you examine their geometrical relationships, especially via the assistance of the classical analog of the spinning translating ball that I gave you, it certainly seems as though the center of geometry is the closest thing to the geometrical center of the particle, quantum or classical. The center of spin is displaced a bit. You combine steady motion with translational motion, and the center of energy is maximally displaced, but all within the molar radial limit.
I asked them to do this, but the center of mass can all fall outside of the system.
Well, you're talking about something that's like has a hollow part.
Yeah.
Semi hollow part.
And the phosphorus flux swings.
Yes, okay.
I guess I do have to confess to a certain simplicity of my intuition about fundamental particles, and I find it hard to imagine giving them the kind of geometrical structure. I mean, okay, yes, strictly speaking, the center of energy could be outside the energy distribution, but not outside in the sense of here's the energy distribution and here's the center of energy. Only outside in the sense of here's the energy distribution, and there's a little hollow here. The center of energy is in there. That's okay by me. It's still in the particle, in general, in a mildly general sense. And I think the same can be said for the center of spin in the
geometric system. No, it's hard to. In these classical examples, of course, if you have an extended hollow of spinning, all these different positions will lie somewhere below that sphere. But now if you, probably if you want to have something like an energy particle, you need to think of something like a point that still has a spin. So what would happen if you take a limit in which the size of the sphere shrinks and its spin?
Well, then of course you get Pauli's rebuke of the suggestion that his classically indescribable two-valuedness of the electron might be interpretable as an internal angular momentum. And he dismissed that out of hand on the grounds that it would require the surface of the spinning electron to move faster than the speed of light. He was thinking of the classical electron radius. He wasn't thinking of the Compton wavelength of the electron. As Muller's argument shows, if you think of the electron or any of these spinning entities as having a space-like extension, not necessarily a hard sphere boundary or anything, not a little marvelous, but having some kind of a space-like extension of the order of magnitude or Compton wavelength, then that Pauli rebuke goes out the window. It makes no sense anymore because the system is big enough, extension-wise. Now, this has some counterintuitive consequences, because these days we believe that some neutrinos are not massless. And nothing I said applies to massless particles, but it applies to all massive particles. And if it turns out that the electron neutrino is among the massive neutrinos, there is a present upper bound of the rest mass of the electron neutrino, I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's in the ballpark of 1/1000th at least the mass of the electron, which if you apply these arguments and take them seriously, that electron neutrino would have to be 1,000 times larger in the spatial extent than an electron. It's the electron neutrino are the size of a hydrogen atom. So there are some counterintuitive features, but I don't see anything about these counterintuitive features that violate any principles.
No, I'm not arguing. It's the fact that you have three different position operators for the same system.
But
is that the only argument for saying that they must have an extension?
Well, there's the field theory argument that I used for the spin zero case, which you can carry up to the spin perhaps case, and the same field theory argument exists as well. I only resorted to the field theory argument because in the case of spin zero, the three positions coalesce. By the way, let me mention with regard, I have focused on three position operators. Obviously, you could start with the center of geometry and add to it P cross S over something with a variable something that would gradually give you a position operator that would take it further and further away. And if you made a sufficiently cockamamie addition, you could take it outside the molar limit. And then you could argue that this is no longer a position that in some sense belongs. But all of these, the three that I focused on, each one of them had some, they had a physical interpretation, which I haven't, I revealed now completely, but strongly suggested. And each one of them has some desirable feature. And I claim the center of energy has the desirable feature that acts like a center of energy. Big H times big X is little x plus little h times x, etc. The center of position can function as a canonical coordinate, has many components, and my separation of angular momentum and orbital internal parts. And the center of geometry does satisfy invariant rule line condition, at least in the absence of interactions without the UI spin. So with those three desirable features, sort of setting them apart and the one's consideration. And then, I guess I have to say I take them seriously enough, the operators themselves, to believe that they tell me that the quantons, those quantons, are extended energies.
Stop and maybe there'll be a lot more questions for you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well.